Flashman. From the Flashman Papers, 1839 to 1842, edited and arranged by George MacDonald Fraser. Read by Timothy West. Explanatory note. The great mass of manuscript known as the Flashman Papers was discovered during a sale of household furniture at Ashby, Leicestershire, in 1965. The papers were subsequently claimed by Mr. Paget Morrison of Durban, South Africa, the nearest known living relative of their author. A point of major literary interest about the papers is that they clearly identify Flashman, the school bully of Thomas Hughes's Tom Brown's school days, with the celebrated Victorian soldier of the same name. The papers are, in fact, Harry Flashman's personal memoirs from the day of his expulsion from Rugby School in the late 1830s to the early years of the present century. He appears to have written them sometime between 1900 and 1905, when he must have been over 80. It is possible that he dictated them. The papers, which had apparently lain untouched for 50 years in a tea-chest, until they were found in the Ashby sale-room, were carefully wrapped in oilskin covers. From correspondence found in the first packet, it is evident that their original discovery by his relatives in 1915, after the great soldier's death, caused considerable consternation. They seem to have been unanimously against publication of their kinsman's autobiography. One can readily understand why, and the only wonder is that the manuscript was not destroyed. Fortunately, it was preserved, and what follows is the content of the first packet, covering Flashman's early adventures. I have no reason to doubt that it is a completely truthful account. Where Flashman touches on historical fact, he is almost invariably accurate, and readers can judge whether he is to be believed or not on more personal matters. Mr. Paget Morrison, knowing of my interest in this and related subjects, asked me to edit the papers. Beyond correcting some minor spelling errors, however, there has been no editing to do. The quotation from Tom Brown's school days was pasted to the top page of the first packet. It had evidently been cut from the original edition of 1856. From Tom Brown's School Days by Thomas Hughes. One fine summer evening, Flashman had been regaling himself on gin punch at Brownsover, and having exceeded his usual limits, started home uproarious. He fell in with a friend or two coming back from bathing, proposed a glass of beer, to which they assented, the weather being hot and they thirsty souls, and unaware of the quantity of drink which Flashman had already on board. The short result was that Flashy became beastly drunk. They tried to get him along, but couldn't, so they chartered a hurdle and two men to carry him. One of the masters came upon them, and they naturally enough fled. The flight of the rest excited the master's suspicions, and the good angel of the fags incited him to examine the freight, and after examination, to convoy the hurdle himself to the schoolhouse. And the doctor, who had long had his eye upon Flashman, arranged for his withdrawal next morning. Hughes got it wrong in one important detail. You will have read in Tom Brown how I was expelled from Rugby School for drunkenness, which is true enough, but when Hughes alleges that this was the result of my deliberately pouring beer on top of gin punch, he is in error. I knew better than to mix my drinks even at 17. I mention this not in self-defense, but in the interest of strict truth. This story will be completely truthful. I am breaking the habit of 80 years. Why shouldn't I? When a man is as old as I am and knows himself thoroughly for what he was and is, he doesn't care much. I'm not ashamed, you see, it never was, and I have enough on what society would consider the credit side of the ledger, a knighthood, a Victoria Cross, high rank, and some popular fame, so I can look at the picture above my desk of the young officer in Cardigan's Hussars, tall, masterful, and roughly handsome I was in those days. Even Hughes allowed that I was big and strong and had considerable powers of being pleasant, and say that it is the portrait of a scoundrel, a liar, a cheat, a thief, a coward, and, oh yes, a toady. Hughes said more or less all these things, and his description was pretty fair, except in matters of detail, such as the one I've mentioned, but he was more concerned to preach a sermon than to give facts. But I am concerned with facts, and since many of them are discreditable to me, you can rest assured that they are true. At all events, Hughes was wrong in saying I suggested beer. It was Speedycut who ordered it up, and I had drunk it on top of all those gin punches before I knew what I was properly doing. That finished me, I was really drunk then. Beastly drunk, says Hughes, and he's right. And when they got me out of the grapes, I could hardly see, let alone walk. They bundled me into a sedan, and then a beak hove in sight, and Speedycut lived up to his name and bolted. I was left sprawling in the chair, and up came the master and saw me. It was old Rufton, one of Arnold's housemasters. "Good God," he said, "it's one of our boys, drunk." I can still see him goggling at me with his great pale gooseberry eyes and white whiskers. He tried to rouse me, but he might as well have tried to wake a corpse. I just lay and giggled at him. Finally he lost his temper and banged the top of the chair with his cane and shouted, "Take him up, chairman, take him to the school. He shall go before the doctor for this." So they bore me off in procession, with old Rufton raging behind about disgusting excesses and the wages of sin, and old Thomas and the chairman took me to the hospital, which was appropriate, and left me on a bed to sober up. It didn't take me long, I can tell you, as soon as my mind was clear enough to think what would come of it. You know what Arnold was like if you read Hughes, and he had no use for me at the best of times. The least I could expect was a flogging before the school. That was enough to set me in a blue funk at the very thought, but what I was really afraid of was Arnold himself. They left me in the hospital perhaps 2 hours, and then old Thomas came to say that the doctor wanted to see me. I followed him downstairs and across to the schoolhouse, with the fags peeping round corners and telling each other that the brute Flashy had fallen at last, and old Thomas knocked at the doctor's door, and the voice crying, "Come in," sounded like the crack of doom to me. He was standing before the fireplace with his hands behind, looping up his coat-tails, and a face like a Turk at a christening. He had eyes like sabre points, and his face was pale and carried that disgusted look that he kept for these occasions. Even with the liquor still working on me a little, I was as scared in that minute as I've ever been in my life. And when you have ridden into a Russian battery at Balaclava and been chained in an Afghan dungeon waiting for the torturers, as I have, you know what fear means. I still feel uneasy when I think of him, and he's been dead 60 years. He was alive enough then. He stood silent a moment to let me stew a little. Then, "Flashman," says he, "there are many moments in a schoolmaster's life when he must make a decision, and afterwards wonder whether he was right or not. I have made a decision, and for once I am in no doubt that I am right. I have observed you for several years now with increasing concern. You have been an evil influence in the school. That you are a bully, I know. That you are untruthful, I have long suspected. That you are deceitful and mean, I have feared. But that you had fallen so low as to be a drunkard, that at least I never imagined. I have looked in the past for some signs of improvement in you, some spark of grace, some ray of hope, that my work here had not in your case been unsuccessful. It has not come, and this is the final infamy. Have you anything to say?" He had me blubbering by this time. I mumbled something about being sorry. "If I thought for one moment," says he, "that you were sorry, that you had it in you to show true repentance, I might hesitate from the step that I am about to take. But I know you too well, Flashman. You must leave Rugby tomorrow." If I'd had my wits about me, I suppose I should have thought this was no bad news. But with Arnold thundering, I lost my head. "But, sir," I said, still blubbering, "it will break my mother's heart." He went pale as a ghost, and I fell back. I thought he was going to hit me. "Blasphemous wretch," he cried. He had a great pulpit trick with phrases like these. "Your mother has been dead these many years, and do you dare to plead her name, a name that should be sacred to you in defense of your abominations? You have killed any spark of pity I had for you." "My father..." "Your father," says he, "will know how to deal with you. I hardly think," he added with a look, "that his heart will be broken." He knew something of my father, you see, and probably thought we were a pretty pair. He stood there, drumming his fingers behind him a moment, and then he said, in a different voice, "You are a sorry creature, Flashman. I have failed in you. But even to you, I must say, this is not the end. You cannot continue here, but you are young, Flashman, and there is time yet. Though your sins be as red as crimson, yet shall they be as white as snow. You have fallen very low, but you can be raised up again." I haven't a good memory for sermons, and he went on like this for some time, like the pious old hypocrite that he was. For he was a hypocrite, I think, like most of his generation. Either that, or he was more foolish than he looked, for he was wasting his piety on me, but he never realized it. Anyway, he gave me a fine holy harangue about how through repentance I might be saved, which I've never believed, by the way. I've repented a good deal in my time and had good cause, but I was never ass enough to suppose it mended anything. But I've learned to swim with the tide when I have to, so I let him pray over me, and when he'd finished, I left his study a good deal happier than when I went in. I'd escaped flogging, which was the main thing. Leaving rugby, I didn't mind a button. I never much cared for the place, and the supposed disgrace of expulsion I didn't even think about. They had me back a few years ago to present prizes. Nothing was said about expulsion then, which shows that they are just as big hypocrites now as they were in Arnold's day. I made a speech, too, on courage, of all things. I left the school next morning in the gig, with my box on top, and they were damned glad to see me go, I expect. Certainly the fags were. I'd given them toco in my time. And who should be at the gate to gloat, I thought at first, but it turned out otherwise, but the bold Scud East. He even offered me his hand. "I'm sorry, Flashman," he said. I asked him what he had to be sorry for, and damned his impudence. "Sorry you're being expelled," said he. "You're a liar," says I, "and damn your sorrow too." He looked at me, and then turned on his heel and walked off. But I know now that I misjudged him. Then he was sorry, heaven knows why. He'd no cause to love me, and if I'd been him, I'd have been throwing my cap in the air and hurrahing. But he was soft. One of Arnold's sturdy fools, manly little chaps, of course, and full of virtue, the kind that schoolmasters love. Yes, he was a fool then, and a fool 20 years later, when he died in the dust at Cawnpore with a sepoy's bayonet in his back. Honest Scud East. That was all that his gallant goodness did for him. I didn't linger on the way home. I knew my father was in London, and I wanted to get over as soon as I could the painful business of telling him I had been kicked out of rugby. So I decided to ride to town, letting my bags follow, and hired a horse accordingly at the George. I am one of those who rode as soon as he walked. Indeed, horsemanship and my trick of picking up foreign tongues have been the only things in which you could say I was born gifted, and very useful they've been. So I rode to town, puzzling over how my father would take the good news. He was an odd fish, the governor, and he and I had always been wary of each other. He was a nabob's grandson, you see, old Jack Flashman, having made a fortune in America out of slaves and rum, and piracy too, I shouldn't wonder, and buying the place in Leicestershire where we've lived ever since. But for all their money bags, the Flashmans were never the thing. The coarse streak showed through generation after generation like dung beneath a rose bush, as Greville said. In other words, while other nabob families tried to make themselves pass for quality, ours didn't, because we couldn't. My own father was the first to marry well, for my mother was related to the Pagets, who, as everyone knows, sit at the right hand of God. As a consequence, he kept an eye upon me to see if I gave myself airs. Before mother died, he never saw much of me, being too busy at the clubs or in the house or hunting, foxes sometimes, but women mostly. But after that, he had to take some interest in his heir, and we grew to know and mistrust each other. He was a decent enough fellow in his way, I suppose, pretty rough and with the devil's own temper, but well enough liked in his set, which was country squire with enough money to pass in the West End. He enjoyed some lingering fame through having gone a number of rounds with Cribb in his youth, though it's my belief that Champion Tom went easy with him because of his cash. He lived half in town, half in country now, and kept an expensive house, but he was out of politics, having been sent to the knacker's yard at Reform. He was still occupied, though, what with brandy and the tables and hunting, both kinds. I was feeling pretty uneasy then when I ran up the steps and hammered on the front door. Oswald, the butler, raised a great cry when he saw who it was, because it was nowhere near the end of the half, and this brought other servants. They scented scandal, no doubt. "My father's home?" I asked, giving Oswald my coat and straightening my neckcloth. "Your father, to be sure, Mr. Harry," cried Oswald, all smiles. "In the saloon this minute." He threw open the door and cried out, "Mr. Harry's home, sir." My father had been sprawled on a settee, but he jumped up when he saw me. He had a glass in his hand, and his face was flushed, but since both these things were usual, it was hard to say whether he was drunk or not. He stared at me and then greeted the prodigal with, "What the hell are you doing here?" At most times this kind of welcome would have taken me aback, but not now. There was a woman in the room, and she distracted my attention. She was a tall, handsome, hussy-looking piece, with brown hair piled up on her head and a come-and-catch-me look in her eye. "This is the new one," I thought, for you got used to his string of madames. They changed as fast as the sentries at St. James's. She was looking at me with a lazy, half-amused smile that sent a shiver up my back at the same time as it made me conscious of the schoolboy cut of my clothes. But it stiffened me, too, all in an instant, so that I answered his question pat. "I've been expelled," I said, as cool as I could. "Expelled? You mean thrown out? What the devil for, sir?" "Drunkenness, mainly." "Mainly? Good God!" He was going purple. He looked from the woman back to me, as though seeking enlightenment. She seemed much amused by it, but seeing the old fellow in danger of explosion, I made haste to explain what had happened. I was truthful enough, except that I made rather more of my interview with Arnold than was the case. To hear me, you would suppose I had given as good as I got. Seeing the female eyeing me, I acted pretty offhand, which was risky, perhaps, with the governor in his present mood, but, to my surprise, he took it pretty well. He'd never liked Arnold, of course. "Well, I'm damned," he said, when I'd finished, and poured himself another glass. He wasn't grinning, but his brow had cleared. "You young doc! A pretty state of things, indeed! Expelled in disgrace, by God! Did he flog you? No? I'd have had the hide off your back. Perhaps I will, damn it!" But he was smiling now. A bit sour, though. "What do you make of this, Judy?" he said to the woman. "I take it this is a relative," she says, letting her fan droop towards me. She had a deep, husky voice, and I shivered again. "Relative? Eh? Oh, damn it, it's my son, Harry, girl. Harry, this is Judy, Miss Parsons." She smiled at me now, still with that half-amused look, and I preened myself. I was 17, remember, and sized up her points while the father got himself another glass and damned Arnold for a Puritan hedge priest. She was what is called Juno-esque, broad-shouldered and full-breasted, which was less common then than it is now, and it seemed to me that she liked the look of Harry Fleshman. "Well," said my father at last, when he'd finished fulminating against the folly of putting prigs and scholars in charge of public schools, "well, what's to be done with you, eh? What'll you do, sir, now that you've disgraced the home with your beastliness, eh?" I'd been thinking this over on the way home, and said straight out that I fancied the army. "The army," he growled. "You mean I'm to buy you colours so that you can live like a king and ruin me with bills at the Guards Club, I suppose?" "Not the Guards," I said. "I've a notion for the 11th Light Dragoons." He stared at this. "You've chosen a regiment already. By gad, here's a cool hand." I knew the 11th were at Canterbury after long service in India, and unlikely for that reason to be posted abroad. I had my own notions of soldiering. But this was too fast for the governor. He went on about the expense of buying in and the cost of army life and worked back to my expulsion and my character generally, and so back to the army again. The port was making him quarrelsome, I could see, so I judged it best not to press him. He growled on, "Dragoons, damn it! Do you know what a cornet's commission cost? Damn nonsense! Never heard the like! Impudence, eh, Judy?" Miss Judy observed that I might look very well as a dashing dragoon. "Eh?" said my father, and gave her a queer look. "Ah, like enough he would. We'll see." He looked moodily at me. "In the meantime, you can get to your bed," he said. "We'll talk of this tomorrow. For the moment, you're still in disgrace." But as I left them, I could hear him blackguarding Arnold again, so I went to bed well pleased and relieved into the bargain. He was odd fish, all right. You could never tell how he'd take anything. In the morning, though, when I met my father at breakfast, there was no talk of the army. He was too busy damning Brougham, who had, I gathered, made a violent attack on the Queen in the House, and goggling over some scandal about Lady Flora Hastings in the Post, to give me much attention, and left presently for his club. Anyway, I was content to let the matter rest just now. I've always believed in one thing at a time, and the thing that was occupying my mind was Miss Judy Parsons. Let me say that while there have been hundreds of women in my life, I have never been one of those who are forever boasting about their conquests. I've raked and ridden harder than most, no doubt, and there are probably a number of middle-aged men and women who could answer to the name of Fleshman if only they knew it. That's by the way, unless you are the kind who falls in love, which I've never been. You take your tumbles when you've the chance, and the more the better. But Judy has a close bearing on my story. I was not inexperienced with women. There had been maids at home and a country girl or two, but Judy was a woman of the world, and that I hadn't attempted. Not that I was concerned on that account, for I fancied myself, and rightly, pretty well. I was big and handsome enough for any of them. But being my father's mistress, she might think it too risky to frolic with the son. As it turned out, she wasn't frightened of the governor or anyone else. She lived in the house. The young queen was newly on the throne then, and people still behave as they had under the Prince Regent and King Billy, not like later on when mistresses had to stay out of sight. I went up to her room before noon to spy out the land, and found her still in bed, reading the papers. She was glad to see me, and we talked, and from the way she looked and laughed and let me toy with her hand, I knew it was only a question of finding the time. There was an Abigail fussing about the room, or I'd have gone for her then and there. However, it seemed my father would be at the club that night, and playing late, as he often did, so I agreed to come back and play a cut with her in the evening. Both of us knew it wouldn't be cards we would be playing. Sure enough, when I did come back, she was sitting, prettying herself before her glass, wearing a bedgown that would have made me a small handkerchief. I came straight up behind her, took her big breasts out in either hand, stopped her gasp with my mouth, and pushed her on the bed. She was as eager as I was, and we bounced about in rare style, first one on top and then the other, which reminds me of something which has stayed in my head, as these things will. When it was over, she was sitting astride me, naked and splendid, tossing the hair out of her eyes. Suddenly she laughed, loud and clearly, the way one does at a good joke. I believed then she was laughing with pleasure, and thought myself a hell of a fellow. But I feel sure now she was laughing at me. I was 17, you remember, and doubtless she found it amusing to know how pleased with myself I was. Later we played cards for form's sake, and she won, and then I had to sneak off because my father came home early. Next day I tried her again, but this time, to my surprise, she slapped my hands and said, "No, no, my boy, once for fun, but not twice. I've a position to keep up here." Meaning my father and the chance of servants gossiping, I supposed. I was annoyed at this and got ugly, but she laughed at me again. I lost my temper and tried to blackmail her by threatening to let my father find out about the night before, but she just curled her lip. "You wouldn't dare," she said. "And if you did, I wouldn't care." "Wouldn't you?" I said. "If he threw you out, you slut." "My, the brave little man," she mocked me. "I misjudged you. At first sight, I thought you were just another noisy brute like your father, but I see you've a strong streak of the cur in you as well. Let me tell you, he's twice the man you are, in bed or out of it." "I was good enough for you, you bitch," I said. "Once," she said, and dropped me a mock curtsy. That was enough. "Now get out and stick to servant girls after this." I went in a black rage, slamming the door, and spent the next hour striding about the park, planning what I would do to her if ever I had the chance. After a while my anger passed, and I just put Miss Judy away in a corner of my mind as one to be paid off when the chance came. Oddly enough, the affair worked to my advantage. Whether some wind of what had happened on the first night got to my father's ears, or whether he just caught something in the air, I don't know, but I suspect it was the second. He was shrewd, and had my own gift of sniffing the wind. Whatever it was, his manner towards me changed abruptly. From harking back to my expulsion and treating me fairly offhand, he suddenly seemed sulky at me, and I caught him giving me odd looks, which he would hurriedly shift away, as though he were embarrassed. Anyway, within 4 days of my coming home, he suddenly announced that he'd been thinking about my notion of the army, and had decided to buy me a pair of colours. I was to go over to the Horse Guards to see my Uncle Bindley, my mother's brother, who would arrange matters. Obviously, my father wanted me out of the house, and quickly, so I pinned him then and there, while the iron was hot, on the matter of an allowance. I asked for £500 a year to add to my pay, and to my astonishment he agreed without discussion. I cursed myself for not asking 750, but 500 was twice what I'd expected, and far more than enough, so I was pretty pleased, and set off the Horse Guards in a good humour. A lot has been said about the purchase of commissions, how the rich and incompetent can buy ahead of better men, how the poor and efficient are passed over, and most of it, in my experience, is rubbish. Even with purchase abolished, the rich rise faster in the service than the poor, and they're both inefficient anyway, as a rule. I've seen 10 men's share of service through no fault of my own, and can say that most officers are bad, and the higher you go, the worse they get, myself included. We were supposed to be rotten with incompetence in the Crimea, for example, when purchase was at its height, but the bloody mess they made in South Africa recently seems to have been just as bad. And they didn't buy their commissions. However, at this time, I'd no thought beyond being a humble cornet and living in a crack regiment, which was one of the reasons I'd fixed on the 11th Dragoons. Also, that they were close to town. I said nothing of this to Uncle Bindley, but acted very keen, as though I was on fire to win my spurs against the Marathas or the Sikhs. He sniffed and looked down his nose, which was very high and thin, and said he had never suspected martial ardour in me. "However, a fine leg in pantaloons and a penchant for folly seem to be all that is required today," he went on. "And you can ride, as I collect." "Anything on legs, Uncle," says I. "That is of little consequence, anyway. What concerns me is that you cannot, by report, hold your liquor. You'll agree that being dragged from a Rugby pothouse reeling, I believe, is no recommendation to an officer's mess." I hastened to tell him that the report was exaggerated. "I doubt it," he said. "The point is, were you silent in your drunken state, or did you rave? A noisy drunkard is intolerable. A passive one may do at a pinch. At least, if he has money. Money will excuse virtually any conduct in the army nowadays, it seems." This was a favourite sneer of his. I may say that my mother's family, while quality, were not over rich. However, I took it all meekly. "Yes," he went on, "I've no doubt that with your allowance you will be able either to kill or ruin yourself in a short space of time. At that you will be no worse than half the subalterns in the service, if no better." "Ah, but wait. It was the 11th Light Dragoons, wasn't it?" "Oh, yes, Uncle. And you are determined on that regiment?" "Why, yes," I said, wondering a little. "Then you may have a little diversion before you go the way of all flesh," said he with a knowing smile. "Have you by any chance heard of the Earl of Cardigan?" I said I had not, which shows how little I had taken notice of military affairs. "Extraordinary. He commands the 11th, you know. He succeeded to the title only a year or so ago while he was in India with the regiment. A remarkable man. I understand he makes no secret of his intention to turn the 11th into the finest cavalry regiment in the army." "He sounds like the very man for me," I said, all eagerness. "Indeed, indeed. Well, we mustn't deny him the service of so ardent a subaltern, must we? Certainly the matter of your colours must be pushed through without delay. I commend your choice, my boy. I am sure you will find service under Lord Cardigan both stimulating and interesting. Yes, as I think of it, the combination of his lordship and yourself will be rewarding for you both." I was too busy fawning on the old fool to pay much heed to what he was saying, otherwise I should have realized that anything that pleased him would probably be bad for me. He prided himself on being above my family, whom he considered boors, with some reason, and had never shown much but distaste for me personally. Helping me into my colours was different, of course. He owed that as a duty to a blood relation, but he paid it without enthusiasm. Still, I had to be as civil as butter to him and pretend respect. End of Side 1.